Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Monday, August 28th, 2017. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Ann Pettifor, author of The Production of Money, How to Bank the Power of Bankers. Also on the program, well, members will be getting something special from our deep archives from power producer Matt Leck. Yes, folks, we are on vacation, desperately hoping that, well, I was going to say Donald Trump is taking a vacation, but he's taken so much vacation over the past 7 months that it's bankrupt the Secret Service.
And it hasn't helped.
So, I don't know. Whatever needs to be done for this guy not to subject the country, to give the country a week off, that's what I say, so that we can actually do some thinking. But this is the way that we do a vacation around here. It's really not a vacation at all. From your perspective, you're still going to get another great classic Majority Report interview today because we care. And that's the way it's going to work this week. We have interviews every day of the week. And members, of course, and you can join them by simply going to jointhemajorityreport.com, signing up for a membership. Members are going to get deep archive shows. I'm not sure what's going to be in there. Matt has full reign in this. This is his domain. But one of them is going to be Dick Gregory, and it's either going to be the show that we had Dick Gregory on the old Majority Report with Janine and I on radio. Dick Gregory passed away last week. Or it's going to be the one with, and I think Janine was in on that one too, if I remember, on Break Room Live. So Dick Gregory, but who knows who else Matt will find in the deep archives. And then on Monday of next week, we will run our Labor Day show, our classic Labor Day show. Folks, have you inherited an old coin collection? Perhaps you have an accumulation of coins and currency you're not sure what to do with. Littleton Coin is here to help. Over 70 years, Littleton Coin has been in business, and they've been helping people just like you sell their coins and currency. As an industry leader in collectible coins and currency, Littleton can pay you more. What are you going to do? You going to keep all those coins in that big, like a shoebox?
Jar.
I have a lot of my old coins in little books. I don't know if they're valuable because I was a kid. I was just, here's a 1971 penny. It didn't mean anything. In 2016, and this is the important part when you're talking about selling a coin collection or really any type of collectibles, the company's president, David Sundman, received the ANA. That's the American Numismatic Association Dealer of the Year Award. Littleton Coin was also honored with a Better Business Bureau Torch Award for Marketplace Ethics. So you know these are people you can trust and rely on. And whether you're an experienced collector or someone who needs help identifying what you have in your collection, Littleton Coin Company is the place to sell your coins. U.S. coins, anyways, and currency. The process is incredibly simple. Visit littletoncoin.com/majority to learn more. Or you can give them a call, toll-free, 877-857-7850. Tell them the Majority Report sent you. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, my interview with Ann Pettifor on The Production of Money, How to Break the Power of Bankers. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Ann Pettifor. She is the director of an economic policy network called Prime Economics and the author of The Production of Money, How to Break the Power of Bankers. Welcome to the program, Ann.
Hi, good evening.
So let's start with, and your book goes great lengths to describe what is money, and then as well as some policy prescriptions. But let's talk about, let's start with what is money. What is money, and what are some of the myths surrounding it?
Well, it seems a silly question, Sam, doesn't it? Because we all know what money is. We deal with it every day. And we're very close with it. Indeed, we're intimate with it, or not. We may not have enough. So we're very emotionally attached to it as well. We think we know it, but we really don't know how it originates, where it comes from, and what it is. And that, unfortunately, is because there's been a lot of hokey-pokey about it. But also... because economists don't take money seriously in many economics textbooks. So let me start by saying this. Joseph Schumpeter once explained that money is nothing more than a promise to pay. That's all. So that's what you, the note, that is what it says on your note, your dollar note or your dollar bill.
So as Joseph Schumpeter explained, money is nothing more than a promise to pay. And the best way to understand this, and as such, it is not a thing. It's not gold. It's not silver. It's simply a promise. It's a social arrangement. And the way to think about it is to think about your credit card. When you go into a shop to buy, say, a washing machine, there is no money in your bank account. You haven't put your savings into your bank account, into your credit card account. There is no money in there yet. What you've done is you've signed a contract, a promise to pay, and you've agreed to pay within a certain time and to pay in rate of interest if you go over that time. But there's no money pre-existing. There are no savings in your credit card account.
And from the perspective of the washing machine store, I have already been vetted, theoretically, by the credit card company as being a fairly reliable or reliable issuer of promises to pay.
That's right. So my card, which might be, I don't know, a silver card, a gold card, they give it all sorts of titles, depending on your creditworthiness, that indicates to the shopkeeper that you are creditworthy, that you will pay. You hand your card over to the shopkeeper. He registers it. He punches it in somewhere. And then he gives it back to you, and you put it back in your pocket. So what you've done is to create money out of thin air. There's no money there. All there is a promise. And your credit card is the thing that says you can trust Adam Pettifor or Sam Jones or whoever to pay this. And the shopkeeper takes that trust and believes in it. And, of course, behind us, you know, in this promise is upheld by a contract. And the contract, in turn, is upheld by a criminal justice system, by the law. But the fact of the matter is that there is no substantial thing, no tangible thing that exchanges. We're just making promises to each other. And with that, I obtain purchasing power, and the shopkeeper makes a sale, and he might make a profit, and so on. So this is a wonderful thing. I argue in my book that monetary systems, well-developed monetary systems, with sound, backed up by sound institutions like the Federal Reserve, a sound accounting system, a strong criminal justice system that enforces and upholds contracts, and a system which regulates the money creation process, regulates the bank that verifies that I'm credit worthy. All of that. That gives us a monetary system. And when we have a sound monetary system like that, there need never be a shortage of money. What there may be are a shortage of promises. You know, I may not be able to make a promise. I may not be able to deliver. I may not be able to do the thing I've said I will do. And I may not be able to generate the income. Those are the limitations that I face. But the money need never be in short supply, because money is a social relationship. My ability to make a promise to you that I'll build your wall, or I'll paint your wall, or I'll do your hair, these are all things that you and I, these are transactions between you and I, and money is only the thing that allows these transactions to happen. It's not scarce like gold. Gold is scarce. our ability to promise each other things is not scarce. But, you know, it might be limited by what we can do and by the fact that, you know, there's a limited amount of, I don't know, steel for washing machines or whatever. Those are real finite limits that we face. But money, there need never be a limit to the amount of money.
And just to tease a couple of these concepts out, because I know you cite David Graeber in your book, book Debt, and we had him on, I guess it was now 5 or 6 years that he wrote that book. But he argues, and I think, you know, compellingly, that, you know, the notion of barter was never really... There are fantasies that barter was a major phenomena, and in many
yes.
respects, it was simply still in many respects pegged to money in some idea. Like
yes. So he argues quite correctly that we've had money systems or credit systems, credo meaning I believe you will pay, credo. Since the beginning of time, since 5,000, you know, before the birth of Christ, 5,000 years before the... And in a village community, I would promise to thatch your roof if you would cut my hair. So we would make these promises to each other. And the village chief would probably be sitting there saying, well, I'm watching you, you know, if you've done that thatching, I want to make sure you cut her hair afterwards, right? So we always had someone, the village chief or the priest, who actually monitored our promises to each other and made sure that we upheld them. Then, as David Graeber explains, it's only when a stranger comes to town that we don't know how to trust that person. We don't know whether or not he will honor his promises, that we engage in barter. So, as David argued correctly, barter was something you did with people that didn't come in within your system of trustworthiness and creditworthiness. So we've had credit systems, promises to pay since before the beginning of time, you know, since ever humanity got together into communities and started to undertake transactions, started to do deals amongst ourselves. I'll skin your pig if you'll, you know, I don't know, catch my chicken.
Right. Well, I mean, I guess the idea being if you're in the village, as
yeah.
it were,
yes.
you don't... There's not the need for a haircut, let's say, is not necessarily sort of a liquid, or I should say the providing of a haircut is not exactly a liquid thing. You got to wait until the person's hair gets long enough to cut. But
yes.
that guy, you know, may be able to fix your, but you may have a hole in your roof right now. So you need the guy
yes.
to fix your roof and then
yeah.
say later, I'll do your haircut. And that works, you know, if you're in a very tight knit community, you got to be
yes.
all within.
Because you can uphold those promises within a tight knit community. Yes, absolutely.
So, and then I want to add just one other aspect that my understanding was enhanced by that book was that the value of money ultimately comes from the value of that money to pay off specific debts, and in this case, usually to the king or the government.
Yes.
as taxes. And so I
yes.
can go far afield. And if I'm within the sphere of the king or, you know, that money can pay for taxes and perhaps services, let's hope, maybe it's just protection services,
yeah.
but will pay off that entity that has some measure of
yeah.
power, I guess.
So there's a difference between money and our promises to pay each other and the currency. And the currency and the value of the currency, the American dollar, is effectively established because taxes are paid in that currency. And that gives it its value. But in that sense, it is also because the currency is then backed up by a form of collateral. And that collateral is or are the, I don't know how many American taxpayers there are, but I reckon it's about 60 million.
Mm-hmm.
There are 60 million taxpayers backing up the American dollar. That is, that everyone knows that America, the United States, has a tax collection system, which is a good, sound tax collection system, and that people pay their taxes, and therefore that the Treasury will collect taxes, come what may, and will go on collecting taxes for the next 30, 50, 60, or even 100 years. We believe in the dollar bill because we know it has value, and we know it has value because it's backed up by American taxpayers. Now, if you go to a little country like Malawi, where they don't have the institutions, they don't have a sound tax collection system, their currency doesn't have value. Because others can see that, A, you know, this currency isn't used for collecting taxes, and secondly, the taxes are not collected. There isn't a system for making sure that everybody pays. Some people do pay, of course, pay taxes in Malawi, but really it isn't as good a system as it is in the United States or in Britain. And so the value of that currency is lower than the dollar or the pound or the euro. So behind all these monetary systems, behind money is always collateral, is always something which stands behind your promise to pay and makes it convincing.
And just to be clear, it is not the fact that we have X number of taxpayers will be able to provide funds that will meet these promises necessarily. It is that because we have a functioning, consistent, stable system of taxation, that it will maintain the value of that currency because of that system.
Absolutely.
Okay.
You've got it. That's it. That's exactly it. It's not that they that the, it's not even that the taxes are paying for anything. It's that we know for sure the government will collect taxes, will be able to collect those taxes, and that gives that institution, that tax collection institution, gives value to the American currency.
This is a very, I think, this is a nuanced point that people really have to understand because I want to talk to that sort of necessity of taxation and the idea that we can't afford things and that it's tied to taxes. We will get to that. But how is money different from credit, or is it simply just a second order promise?
No, so money is credit. All credit ends up as money. All money begins as credit. So it's very hard for us to grasp this, because what happens is we leave school, we leave college, we get a job, and we work for a month, and at the end of the month we're paid. And we therefore suffer the delusion that we have somehow created or earned the money that we get paid at the end of the month. But in fact, there had to be credit to enable the employer in the first instance to employ people, to employ you. And so credit is the beginning of everything, really. It is where all money begins. So the employer arranges some credit, either most helpfully with a bank. Now, again, in countries that don't have banks or a banking system, it's not possible for firms to obtain credit very easily. It means you've got to rely on somebody's savings if you want to employ people. You've got to go and find someone who's built up a pile of savings. And in old medieval times, you know, when we think about it, in ancient times before there was a banking system, say the farmer had worked on a piece of land and wanted to expand his piece of land, he wouldn't have had enough money himself. He wouldn't have accumulated enough savings to buy an extra piece of land. So he would then troop up the hill to the lord of the manor, and the lord of the manor will have in his vaults supplies of gold, savings, and so on, which he will have acquired through fair means or foul. And so the poor peasant would have had to go on knees, bended knee, and beg for money from the wealthy baron. And the wealthy baron would probably say, yeah, I'll lend you some money, but I'm going to charge you 15% or 20% or whatever, you know, as high a rate of interest as he possibly could extract from the poor peasant. Now, when we developed a banking system, it was no longer necessary to go to those who were the holders of savings to get money. You could go to the bank and you could say to the bank, I'm going to start a business. I'm going to grow tomatoes. I know it's going to be profitable. We've got a good climate here. I've got a market. Please, will you give me some credit? You get obtained credit. And the bank doesn't say to you, well, you're not a member of my family or, you know, I don't know, blah, blah. The bank judges you or should judge you on the basis of your income, your potential income, and gives you the credit. So what happened was when we developed banks and a banking system, we democratized the access to credit. Before that, you had to go to the big bad barons to get money. Now you could go to the bank and you could make a case and say, look, I want to build a steam engine. Nobody's ever built one before, but I want to build one. And so I always argue that the Industrial Revolution here in Britain correlates with the fact that we developed a banking system, and so risk takers and entrepreneurs could go to the bank and get some credit to invest in their enterprise. And so it was much more fair and easier.
Let me put a slight asterisk there, just because we know that. At least in the context of this country, there has been the democratization is still in many respects an ongoing process for even the simplest of loans. We've had redlining in this country. We've had a lot of racial discrimination and whatnot. But theory and like aspirationally, like you say, that's the way it should work. And then also, let me just take this opportunity to say, this dynamic, and tell me if I'm wrong, that is, and we haven't heard it, I haven't heard it probably in 7 or 8 years, but it's important for the next go round. This is a perfect example of when you're a business or you want to be a business and you have no money, borrowing money is the way that you make money. So when they had a problem, when there was a problem, particularly with on the right of you know, it's not common sense to borrow money when you're in a hole. Actually, no, it is fairly common sense. Companies do it all the time.
Yes. Now, the really important thing is that, you know, if your business, if you don't know how much profit your business is going to make, then it's important for you not to be charged a very high rate of interest on what you borrow, so that, that your business can become sustainable. And we know that over time, historically over time, most firms make profits of no more than 3% a year. Sometimes it's higher, of course, and sometimes they make losses. But that's on average over time what the average firm makes. And so we argue, and John Maynard Keynes argued, was that banks should make loans to entrepreneurs, but should always keep interest rates low. And that process should be managed, because while banks are wonderful and have democratized the access to credit, they can also capture that power and abuse it. And they can abuse it by saying, right, we're going to be free to charge whatever rate we want to charge on our loans. And that's what happened in the early 1970s. I think it was called Regulation Q in the United States. There was a limit on how much banks, American banks, could charge in interest. There was a limit, if you like, to the usury that banks could employ on loans. And those limits were lifted with deregulation, and banks were given permission to charge whatever they liked. And what the theory then was, well, you know, the market will decide what is a good rate. And if the market thinks it's a good thing to lend at 15%, and if there are people willing to borrow and pay 15%, they shall get a loan. Now, you know, for me, that's problematic, and we can discuss that further if you like later.
I want to circle back around.
But the thing, although I'm clear that a banking system is a civilizational advance and it democratizes access to credit, I also am very clear that that process has to be managed in the interests of the economy as a whole and not just the 1%.
All right. So now that we've established, you know, the concept of money and how that is differentiated from currency, I want to get into sort of, you know, the financial crisis and to what extent any of what we're talking about was implicated there. But just the relationship, before we do, the relationship between currency and money. I mean, obviously, obviously currency is, you know, the way that I guess we manifest the concept of money in different first, I guess, geographic locations, and then sort of more, I don't know, I guess, relation, you know, psychographic. I'm not sure how you would express that. But but what is the relationship between currency and money?
It's simply that currency, so money is a promise to pay, and then the value of our promises, if you like, is what is determined by the currency. So when I live in a very poor country with hardly any resources and landlocked perhaps and with lots of problems and disease and whatever, the potential value of my promises is going to be quite low. If I live in a very rich country like the United States or Britain or Europe, all the countries in Europe, then the value of my promises and which then is my currency, is higher. It's higher because it's backed up by all of the productivity, the goods and the income that my country as a whole generates and that I'm part of. So currency is the value of promises. When we make promises, we need to be able to understand when I promise to cut your hair, and I say I will cut your hair, and this is how much it'll be, this is how much it'll cost, and you promise to pay that. You want some idea of what the haircut is going to cost and what the value of that haircut is. And so in rich countries, the thing that we use to establish value is the currency. And the value of currency in rich countries tends to be higher than the value of currency in poor countries.
And that's not a function of the value of that currency is not a function of the value of that haircut. It's just that there's so many haircuts going on a regular basis in that system that haircutter happens to inhabit, that you can really, really trust that haircut's going to happen.
Yes, and so it is like a standard.
Okay.
It's a bit like saying that, you know, if I go into a pub and I order a pint of beer, I want to be able to know that a pint is a pint is a pint. And, you know, we've always had regulators watch the publican and ensure that he is selling a pint, that the value of that beer, wherever it is the same. So the currency measures the value, and we need that value measurement as part of our transaction, as part of our promises to pay.
So, okay, so how much of this understanding of money is implicated in the financial crisis that we saw in 08?
Yeah, well, first of all, there's a very poor understanding of money. You need to know, and this is quite shocking, actually, that economists on the whole don't learn about money, debt, or banks in their university courses. Even sound economist people, from my point of view, economists like Paul Krugman, who's written a really good book on macroeconomics, doesn't deal with money, banks, and debt in any great detail. And when he does, he treats banks as intermediaries between savers and borrowers. And banks have not been intermediaries between savers and borrowers. They manage the transactions, the promises that others make to pay. That's all that banks do. And they do that without collecting savings first of all. They do that, if you like, they create credit out of thin air. So the problem with what happened with the financial crisis was that there's very little understanding of finance and of credit. And because there's this misunderstanding, people were blinded, couldn't see what the problem was, couldn't understand what the problem was. And the problem had been financial deregulation. You know, throughout our history, we've had chiefs or priests or people of distinction in our communities that have managed our promises to pay. And what happened with the deregulation of the financial system in the 60s and the 70s was that the banker said, we don't need a chief or a priest or a Securities and Exchange Commission or, you know, a regulatory body to tell us how to do our business. The market will do this. The market will discipline us if we go wrong. You know, the market knows best. So if a, I don't know if we've all seen, I hope we've all watched The Big Short, which is really one of the best movies about the crisis there was. And the scene where the Wall Street guy goes to Florida to examine the subprime housing market. And they're in a nightclub one night, and the pole dancer is swinging around the pole. And he says to the pole dancer, "Have you got a mortgage?" And she says, "Have I got a mortgage? I've got 5 mortgages." And so what we saw happen there was the banks found the pole dancers of this world who are in precarious jobs with uncertain incomes, but who also didn't have a roof over their heads necessarily, and offered them not one but 5 mortgages. But the condition was that the pole dancer would have to pay a very high rate of interest because she was a risky borrower. And so she was charged about, 15%, and I don't know if it was as high as that. What happens is the pole dancer really can't repay one mortgage or even 5 mortgages at that very high rate of interest because her pay, her income from, you know, her tips don't rise at that rate of interest every year. And so she doesn't, her income doesn't keep up with her need to repay these debts. And so she crashed. Now, the trouble was that in the first instance, the banker makes a hell of a lot of money out of subprimers because they can charge subprimers the highest rates of interest. The riskiest borrowers get charged the highest rates of interest. So the banks were moving to the riskiest borrowers because they just wanted to collect the money. They wanted to just fix the highest price. And as a result, you know, there was a massive expansion of credit to risky borrowers who weren't going to repay. Now, that was a result of the deregulation of the management of the financial system. When our authorities said, we don't need to manage this system, the market will do it. We can trust the market to work. People like Greenspan had complete belief that the market would make sure that nobody did anything foolish like sell 5 mortgages to a pole dancer. But of course, you know, bankers got very greedy. The finance sector got very greedy. This is easy money. This is effortless money. Mm. When I grow tomatoes, I have to engage with the land on the one hand and with labor on the other. Giving out mortgages just means entering numbers into a computer and collecting the interest, and it's almost effortless activity.
So what ultimately, ultimately, it was just farming for these interest rates, and then later, as we've talked about in this program many different ways, there was all sorts of almost fraud, I guess you could call it, and probably in some instances fraud in collecting fees and divorcing the originators from the people who theoretically should be collecting on it, and a miscommunication about the risk, about the promise, I guess, that was made to pay, and the ability to pay, and a willful denial by the people who accepted that promise because they didn't have to hold that promise. They were able to give the promissory note to somebody else and say, "Yeah, sure, it's great."
So they passed the parcel, but they also, you know, collected up. They created new products. So they'd take a bundle of mortgages, bundle them up, sell them on again, charge interest on that, get that guaranteed. Get it AAA rated, you know, make it, and then people would greedily buy the bundle of mortgages, thinking that they had an asset that was going to generate income over time, and so it all carried on as if, you know, so the real collateral, which was A, the property itself, and B, the ability of the owner, the borrower, to generate income, all of that got left behind in this fantasy that you could kind of just repackage all these assets and keep milking them of rent, if you like, keep extracting rent from them. And there clearly was a limit to that because it, you know, it was detached from the real world of real meaningful collateral or assets and real meaningful income. So, you know, it all got, I mean, and yes, there was a great deal of fraud and theft and dishonesty and so on. And that happens, you know, if we took away the red lights on our road system, people would just go speeding along and kill themselves and kill others, you know. We've always needed to be managed and to be regulated. If we were free to roam the streets and rob, a lot of us would do that, you know, because we want easy money. I mean, it's in human nature. And so we have to be managed. We have to be regulated. We have to be restrained in our behavior, in our conduct, if we want to be a civilized society. The finance sector persuaded authorities that they did not have to be managed. They did not have to be regulated, that they could be trusted, that the market would sort everything out. And that was the delusion.
So what is it between the understanding of money and what we saw with that deregulation? Is it simply that money can't, things will break down if the parties are not, I guess, constrained from creating illusions of really of promises in some way, or illusions surrounding the promises that might benefit them short term.
So, you know, there's a lot of people who go around arguing that money is like gold or silver, or it should be like gold or silver. And with that sort of delusion, I don't know that if you don't really understand that money is a social relationship and has to be managed, then you are of the view that you needn't worry too much because there's only limited amounts of it and it'll run out. I don't know what it was that informed the way that people like Alan Greenspan thought about money, but I think it was based on a flawed understanding of the nature of our social relationships.
So if you understand...
And that's partly because we fetishized the thing, the dollar bill or the bar of gold that represents our promises to pay. We fetishized those, and then we began to develop theories around those things. It's quite difficult to understand and to explain.
So what you're suggesting is that if you perceive money as a commodity in the same way you would gold or tulips back in the day, or for that matter, Bitcoin. If you hold that position that it's a commodity and therefore finite, it's not a dynamic between people, then you will perceive that as providing the discipline necessary, and there is no reason to manage these relationships from the outside because it's a finite commodity and the law of physics takes over, and that's the problem. Money is not a finite commodity, and physics will not take over.
You've got it there, absolutely. I couldn't have put it better myself. Okay. That is absolutely the case.
So let me ask you this. Talk to me about the rollback of Bretton Woods, because Bretton Woods, it seems to me, and those people who want us to go, I mean, there's few, but there's probably more than there should be, of people who talk about returning to a gold standard. You have the same, but there's another problem associated with that, right? In that, like, promises keep getting made, or that our economy is bigger than that, can't be constrained by a commodity without having real problems. Explain that dynamic.
Well, the point is this, that Bretton Woods was Bretton Woods was built. It's a financial architecture for the world, actually. It was a form of financial architecture for the global economy. And it was built by Roosevelt commissioning a bunch of economists who met at Bretton Woods. And very interesting, by the way, the Bretton Woods Conference, Roosevelt banned the bankers from attending the Bretton Woods Conference. It was only attended by economists from all over the world. And they thought that they would have to reconstruct the international financial system to make it more stable, because the architecture pre-1929 had been very unstable. And that was why the global economy had collapsed. So this is like building a high-rise block on very lousy foundations. If you do that, you get instability and the thing collapses. And so they were determined to build the financial system in such a way as to never again have a crisis on the scale of 1929. They knew they had to manage certain things for that to happen. They had to manage the creation of credit. You know, they were clear that you had to create credit for productive activity that was going to generate income. If you created credit for the purposes of speculation, for gambling, you were going to end up in a mess, as it happened with the stock market in 1929. So that, they were very clear about the creation of credit. They were also clear about that you had to have limits on the rate of interest on that credit, because it was a social relationship, an effortless activity, and it should never be charged very high rates. So that was what they were clear about. They were also clear that you had to establish balance between nations, that you couldn't have one nation with a massive surplus in another nation with a massive deficit in trade or capital flows, because those imbalances would lead to political tensions, and those political tensions would lead to war. And that's what had happened before 29 and before 33. The massive imbalances had built up in the world. And so as part of reconstructing the international financial architecture, the economists at Bretton Woods resolved that in future the international financial system would be managed to maintain balance. When a country got into surplus, it would be disciplined. It would cost you if you built up too much of a surplus. If you built up a deficit, that you would be disciplined as well. And there would be a global central bank that would take money from the person in surplus, from the countries in surplus, and lend to the countries in deficit on terms, and ensure that some balance was restored between these nations. And they were very clear that we had to do that in order to never again have a war and to have the kind of depression and war that we suffered from 1933 onwards with Hitler and so on. And then what happened was that they managed to begin the construction of this system, and they used the dollar as the world's reserve currency, and they valued the dollar relative to gold. But it wasn't really a gold standard in the sense that it had been before the First and Second World, before the First World War, and then immediately after the First. It wasn't a gold standard in that sense. It was just simply that the dollar was to maintain this value at a relatively stable level in order to be the world's reserve currency, and they valued it in terms of gold. And that we went along quite happily until one Sunday night in 1971, when Richard Nixon decided unilaterally to dismantle the whole international financial system overnight without consulting any of his partners in the world and without having a substitute for the old architecture. He simply dismantled it and said that the United States could no longer pay her debts in gold, which is what the French were demanding, that instead she would pay her debts in greenbacks, in dollar bills. And that was the end of the Bretton Woods system. And we've never reconstructed an international financial architecture since then. We've allowed things simply to grow as willy-nilly, as the market determines. So we're now in a position where the United States this time round has a massive deficit with China, and China has a massive surplus. And these ultimately are going to lead to tensions once again. The deficit that the United States has caused political unrest inside America. I think it's one of the causes of the election of President Trump.
Now, we should say we're specifically talking about the trade deficit.
We're talking about the trade deficit, but also, you know, we're talking about the current account deficit. The fact of the matter is, you know, there's now massive imbalances between nations in the world. And people are very unsettled by those imbalances, you know, because the major adjustments have had to be made to different economies. And many Americans feel left behind by this process. So, and that people felt pretty much the same in Germany in the 1930s. And so, you know, we have to be very careful, because these economic tensions lead to political tensions. These economic imbalances lead to political tensions. And so when people call for a restoration of Bretton Woods, I think they're calling for a restoration of some stability and to an end to the imbalances around the world, rather than for a return to the gold standard.
All right, so let me ask this then in that respect. That my understanding is that when we untethered our money from gold, or our currency, I guess we should say,
yes,
that it then, I mean, this is, I guess, modern monetary theory, and I'm curious as to where your perspective is consistent or is at odds with modern monetary theory as you know it.
Yes.
But it seems to me that when we untethered our currency from gold, it allowed us the ability to print as much as we wanted or it was necessary at any time. I mean, do you and that gold was, as far as I understand it, and I'm unclear around this area, is that it would constrain our ability to provide money into the system if, you know, basically money into the system if the private sector of the economy was not generating enough activity.
Yes. So what happened in the United States, and the reason why Nixon dismantled the Bretton Woods system, was that the Americans built up a deficit with the rest of the world, and they did that because they had launched a war in Vietnam. And this was a very costly war. And in order to pay for their foreign debts, the Americans were obliged to pay in dollars linked to gold. And President de Gaulle in France was particularly difficult about this. He insisted the Americans had to pay their debts in gold and not just by issuing greenbacks. And in a sense, because of this big overdraft, if you like, that the Americans had built up in their current account deficit, the rest of the world became suspicious about America being able to pay. And so de Gaulle would demand to be paid in gold. And at some point, you know, the gold in Fort Knox began to run out. And Nixon's advisors came to him and said, look, this is unsustainable. We can't go on doing this. Now, what would normally happen, what happens today in the rest of the world, if you go to a poor country, when a poor country builds up a deficit like that and can no longer pay its debts, it has to undergo what the IMF calls a structural adjustment. It has to adjust its economy to generate the kind of income that will enable it to repay its debts. Mainly, you know, if it's a country like Rwanda, it has to start growing coffee beans so that it can export coffee beans, earn dollars, and repay its dollar debts, right? Now, what happened with the United States in 1971 is that Nixon just dogmatically refused to structurally adjust the American economy to generate income needed to repay foreign debts. He said, we're not going to do that. I'm not going to ask the American people to tighten their belts. I'm about to stand for election, for goodness sake, and I'm not going to do that because it'll make me very unpopular. Instead, I'd rather just simply, you know, dismantle the whole system. So America never structurally adjusted its economy in order to earn the money it needed to repay its debts. And instead, it just defaulted on, if you like, on its obligations. So,
but
you know, this is an extraordinary period in history, and it's not often written about or talked about. But it's really important because normally an economy would have to adjust itself and stop shopping, if you like, abroad or incurring expenses abroad, which is what the United States was doing, and start generating income at home in order to restore balance. But that wasn't done.
But it's not. But the rest of the world's not asking for income. It's asking for money,
it's asking for repayment of debts that the United States owed to the rest of the world. And it was asking for those debts to be repaid in gold.
Right. Okay. And so, that was the issue as opposed to the acceptance of dollars.
Well, what happened after that was that, you know, people like President de Gaulle were told, if you don't like, you know, so now the world's reserve currency, if you like, is United States sovereign debt. So treasury bills, which are debts, American debts, mm-hmm. are now at the base, if you like, of the global financial system. We don't have gold anymore as our reserve currency. We have U.S. Treasury bills, effectively. People buy U.S. Treasury bills to put into their central banks to show that they have some assets in the bank, valuable assets in the bank. So it's now American debt, which is at the base of the global financial system. We're getting into deep waters here.
Well, yes, no, but as such, I mean, but this, I mean, so as such, because yes. Now the U.S. dollar functions yes. like a commodity in that sense, right?
Yes.
I mean, to other sovereign nations, that
yes.
we can actually print more money, right? That is, we're
yes.
not necessarily tethered to something, let's say, like a Greece is to the euro, because they don't have the ability to just basically print money. We could theoretically do that because we're headed towards a debt ceiling crisis. And
yeah,
and there's some question as to whether or not the executive, the Treasury Department has the unilateral authority. I mean, I've seen it argued pretty compellingly that it does, to simply print, or I should say mint, a trillion-dollar coin, let's say, and could pay off the debt. And theoretically, the cost of things under a modern monetary theory is that is not an obstacle if we're talking about U.S. dollars because we can print those dollars.
Yeah, and that, I mean, I think I differ from some of the MMTers in arguing that isn't limitless, that isn't without limits. There are limits to our ability to, if you like, create credit. And the fact is, I mean, it is the case that the Federal Reserve could write off. So we're now talking, there are two kinds of debt. There's your foreign debts that are owed to
right.
foreigners, and there's domestic debt. And, you know, if you take Japan, for example, Japan's debts at the moment are its domestic debts, so 300% of its GDP, 300% of its annual income. And Japan purrs along happily. You know, they have full employment. They keep going. So really, the issue is, from the point of view of, there's got to be some stability and some management of the system. We can't have endless amounts of debt. And we've got to generate the income that helps to repay those debts and helps to balance out the system. Because otherwise debts, if you like, exceed the ability of repayment massively and get us into difficulty. But I think we're getting confused here between
okay.
printing money on the one hand, foreign currency on the other hand, and then the question of the government's fiscal deficit. And that's, you know, that's a whole other area. Really.
Okay, well then let's go into your prescriptions about what needs to happen in terms of, particularly in the banking system, maintain, you know, or to avoid a crash like we saw, and to sort of, I guess, provide for society broadly speaking, and I guess, you know, to prevent what we saw in 2008 and everything that led up to it, and frankly, that's continued on after.
Yes. Well, I think what we need to do is to manage the system, and that's the word that I prefer to use. I prefer that to regulating the system. I think we just have to manage it. We cannot pretend that there are some abstract forces called the market that can govern us. We can't be governed by something detached from us. We have to govern ourselves, if you like, and govern the system that we invented and we created, and which is a system of social relationships. So the first thing that has to happen is that we have to restore some regulation. And I know and I understand the very reverse is happening right now. But Glass-Steagall, for example, is an absolute necessity, that banks should be required to, if they take risks with their own money, that's fair and good enough. And they're free to do that, but they should not link that to retail banking, which is protected and backed, if you like, by American taxpayers via the government. So, you know, this is a very, for me, this is terribly commonsensical that if banks are going to go out and gamble and speculate, they should do so at their own risk and not at risk of American taxpayers. As things currently stand, because we don't have Glass-Steagall, the American taxpayer is in hock to these banks and is going to have to bail them out again next time they mess up. And the banks can't believe their luck, because before the crisis, they were pretty well exposed. Before the separation of Glass-Steagall, of both the investment and retail arms of banking, of the banking system, banks were at risk of not being protected by the state. After the crisis, banks are far too big to fail and far too big to jail. And so now they can do business knowing that they will always be bailed out, that they will never go to jail. And that must be wonderful. You know, if you think of other entrepreneurs and risk takers, they don't get those sorts of public guarantees. You know, I mean, this is like the old Soviet system, where, you know, the government backed up all enterprises in the Soviet Union. It's not really very different. So today we have a system, a financial system, which is still engaging in speculative and reckless activity. But the difference is that now they're absolutely backed up by taxpayers and very confident that the taxpayer will always be there to bail them out. And that's dangerous. That's very dangerous. So I think we've got to go back to a system where we separate the if you like, speculative arms of banks from their retail banking, and we allow them to take risks, but also for the market truly to discipline if their risks go wrong. And only retail banking, if you like, should be protected by government. And there's a great deal more in the way of regulation that I think we should undertake if we're going to have stability. And one of my one of the things that I really think very important is to the management of capital flows across borders, so that people and firms can't make profits and capital gains and store them in Panama or other places and avoid taxes. So there's an awful lot of management of the financial system that needs to happen.
And lastly, just talk about the setting of interest rates and, yes. And why, I mean, you would manage, I guess, in your terminology, these more so than, well, certainly we do in this country. There's a cap, obviously. You can't, unless I guess you're a check cashing place, it gets pretty high. But you can't, as a commercial entity that is backed by the FDIC, you have limits on what you can charge in terms of interest, but you would specifically set interest rates. Is that right?
Well, Keynes, I mean, it's quite complicated, but Keynes had developed a theory for managing the government's assets in such a way as to meet all the preferences of various savers and people that need money in order to manage the rate of interest across the spectrum of lending, both for short-term and long-term lending, safe and risky lending, and also in real terms, in terms of inflation and so on. But that's a very long and complicated theory to develop here. But it was possible, and indeed it happened between 1933 and the 1960s, that the central banks managed the system in such a way as to keep interest rates low across the board. And that wasn't just by legally enforcing limits. It was, if you like, by a system of offering a range of preferences to borrowers and those who needed finance, either short-term or long-term, in such a way as to keep rates low. And, you know, the central bank, the Fed at the moment, is trying to keep interest rates low by pegging the bank rate very low. But although that affects lending between banks, the Fed doesn't actually influence lending out in the private sector, out in the markets for overdrafts and that kind of thing. Those rates are still, in real terms, in my view, high. And the Fed doesn't see its responsibility as managing rates, those rates across the spectrum.
All right,
but
well,
it ought to.
Ann Pettiford, the book is The Production of Money, How to Break the Power of Bankers. Thank you so much for coming on today. I really appreciate it.
That's a pleasure. Thank you very much.